Hello and welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. When today's guest, Sarah Perry, would tell people that she was an Essex girl, her remarks would be met with a knowing smirk. Why? That's the question at the heart of her latest book, which pinpoints what it is that makes an Essex girl. And it's not white high heels, but rather a convention-defying radicalism and a sense of pluck. Sarah, the author of three wildly successful novels, After Me Comes the Flood, The Essex Serpent, and Melmoth, then delves into the lives of famous Essex girls, from TOWIE star Gemma Collins to the abolitionist Anne Knight. I love talking to her about this, as well as about her late start in writing, her phenomenally successful novels, and her strict Baptist upbringing. Sarah, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the Sunday Salon.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's such a privilege to have you on, and I'm really excited to talk to you. I really loved the book, and as we were just saying before we started recording, my mum is an Essex girl, so I have a particular vested interest, and I think she'll be getting a copy of the book for Christmas. So highly recommend it.
Thank you.
I wonder if we can just start with you explaining the concept of the book and why you decided to write it, because it's quite different from your other work.
It is, and it has quite an interesting start point, which is that I was invited to give the Harriet Martineau lecture by the National Writing Centre last year. And the National Centre for Writing is based in Norwich, which is where I now live, and that's where Harriet Martineau was from. And she was a fascinating woman who's slightly been written out of history. She was a political radical and a proto-feminist and an abolitionist, and a real radical, actually, in the way she lived, in her attitude towards religion, in the way she dressed and behaved. And she was really unpopular. And she got me thinking about the kinds of women that are unpopular and why they're unpopular. And it's often because they speak out of turn, they're thought to be too loud, to dress wrong, to have the wrong kind of body. And it just made me think of Essex girls. And I'm from Essex. I was born in Chelmsford right at the end of 1979, so grew up in the 80s and 90s. And yeah, I think she's an Essex girl. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do a lecture on Essex girls and radical women of Essex and elsewhere, and to try to kind of claim that an Essex girl is an amazing thing to be, daring and radical and willing to, you know, get on the nerves of society. And eventually that turned into the book. So that's where it came from, which is quite an interesting path, I think.
And the way you sort of define Essex girl is not literal necessarily. It's not necessarily people who are from Essex. It's something more than that. Is that right?
That's right, yeah, because the insult Essex girl and all the jokes about it were never just about girls that were born in Essex. It's about a kind of woman. And it's about a kind of woman who is obnoxious to everybody's prejudices. So the Essex girls jokes kind of started in the 80s and 90s. Round about the time of Thatcher is when it kind of came about. And, you know, the joke is that she's vulgar, she has lots of sexual partners, that she lives in social housing, that she's not educated, that she dresses in this very provocative way, that she has an annoying accent. And traditionally, people have said, no, that's not what Essex girls are like. They're nothing like that. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to say, actually, you know, all of those things are amazing and they're politically very radical. So a woman who doesn't dress the way that the establishment thinks she should dress is a remarkable creature. A woman that doesn't shut up when people think that she should shut up is capable of achieving great things. And the thing about the idea of the Essex girl is that, you know, those on the left could hate her for being capitalist and vulgar and materialistic, and then those on the right would hate her for needing social housing and, you know, requiring benefits to look after her children. So she became this really convenient football for everybody to kick.
And one of the things you describe in the book is sort of when you became aware of people's reaction to the fact that you were from Essex, you went off to study, and you'd sort of say, people say, where are you from? And you'd say Essex, and they'd kind of laugh and look you up and down and sort of say, an Essex girl. And yet, despite that being kind of, I suppose, a new experience, somewhere in your mind you sort of knew what the implications were. Can you just tell me a little bit about that, and sort of, I suppose, how you became aware that
the place of your birth was sort of a punchline.
Yeah, I've spoken to other Essex girls about this as well, and it was always people from outside the county, because of course we didn't say it about ourselves, you know. And so it would be when you went to elsewhere in the UK, and that might be because you're on holiday with your parents and you were going to Scotland or Cornwall or whatever, or if you went up to university, and people would have all those ordinary conversations about where are you from. And then if you said you were from Essex, there would almost always be an Essex girl joke. So they would say, are you called Sharon? Are you called Tracy? Where are your white stiletto heels? Do you dance around your handbag? All of this stuff. And, you know, the way stereotypes work means that all of us, particularly people of colour, obviously, are met with stereotypical responses. So, you know, someone from Scotland might get a really crap joke about haggis, you know. So nobody's immune from this. But the thing with the Essex girls is that there was entire volumes of books, you know, devoted to Essex girl jokes. It was so toxic that it kind of went into the culture, and in a way that, you know, Geordie lasses or, you know, people from, you know, Birmingham, who, you know, people might take the mick out of their accent, but it's not quite so toxic and widespread as the terrible sexist, misogynistic, hateful stuff that Essex girls will get. And I have to say, it's really important for me to emphasise that this is not oppression. You know, this is not what women of colour get. This is not what queer women get. That's oppression. That is structural oppression. This is different. This is mockery. And it's really important for me to say that, because otherwise it sounds like, you know, white women complaining that people take the mick. And that's all it is. You know, it's toxic, but it's not oppression.
I want to ask you about some of the women in particular that you go into in the book. But before I do, I wonder if I could just ask a little bit of background about you and I suppose your childhood. You grew up in a very religious family, but you've described yourself as post-religious. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so one of the reasons the Essex girl joke kind of slipped by me for years and years was that I was brought up a strict Baptist, and what that effectively means is that I was sort of brought up towards the end of the 19th century. So the chapel that my parents attended and my parents themselves believed very firmly that the world, you know, as seen through popular culture, was very wicked and very sinful. So we had no television. I never went to the cinema, wasn't allowed to go to the cinema or to parties or to listen to pop music or anything like that. So we had classical music and Radio 4 would be allowed. No contemporary literature until I did A-level English, really. So I read Hardy and Shakespeare all through my childhood. Wasn't allowed to wear trousers or makeup or anything like that. So I looked very different as well. And because I was sort of the opposite of an Essex girl, you know, I didn't wear tight, short dresses and never went to parties, it seemed to have nothing to do with me for years and years. And so much of that was about the faith and about living a life that is very, very tied to chapel and to what everyone expects of you. And I no longer worship anywhere, actually, with any regularity. I haven't lost my faith particularly, but post-religious is the best way of describing where I am. So it's been a strange and interesting journey into the modern world. And it took me probably 15 years really to be comfortable talking about popular culture at all, or even to recognise the kind of songs that were coming on the radio and to be able to have a guess at who it might be. So it's been a life of feeling kind of displaced, I suppose.
You describe going to school in an interview that you've given before, going to school and sort of someone saying, take that, and you say, take what?
Yeah.
I'm interested how that felt as a child feeling, or as a young person feeling like an outsider in such a sort of overt and noticeable way. I mean, did it upset you? Were you pretty au fait with it? Did you kind of take consolation in something else? How did that feel?
So there were definitely times when I didn't like feeling so strange. And actually, one of the biggest memories that I have of kind of public humiliation was that when I was about 14 or 15, we visited my uncle, my father's brother, and he was a minister, but nothing like the, you know, the strict closed off religious world that I was brought up in. So they had a television. And it was Christmas, and so that we all sat down and watched Where Eagles Dare, and it was such a rare thing to watch a film that I was just completely transfixed. I thought it was one of the best things I'd ever seen. And of course, the lead actor was Clint Eastwood, and I had absolutely no idea that it was an old film. As far as I was concerned, it could have been made the year before. I didn't know who he was. And then when we went back to school, lots of the girls at school were talking about actors that they fancied, and they were naming sort of young men, and I said, oh, Clint Eastwood's really handsome. And of course, by that stage, he would have been late into his 60s. And everybody just laughed and laughed and laughed, not unkindly. You know, these were really nice girls who have become really good women. But of course, it's really funny if a 14-year-old says that she's attracted to a pensioner, and someone had to explain to me that, no, you don't understand, that was made, you know, in the 60s. He's very different now. And I found that really difficult because I didn't understand what was funny. And I think that's really hard for kids. If you've been stupid and everybody laughs, it's not great, but you understand why they're laughing. If you have no idea what's funny, it's really hard to kind of negotiate the world, because how can you avoid doing it again if you didn't know you were doing it the first time? So that has really stuck in my mind. But I was really fortunate in that all I wanted to do was read, write, and play the piano and do paintings. And that was what was open to me. So if I'd been a different kind of girl and I'd wanted to listen to pop music and I'd wanted boyfriends and parties, I would have been unhappy. But I was just a real spod. I just wanted to stay home listening to plays on Radio 4 and playing Rachmaninoff. So it sort of suited me, really.
Can I ask how that has affected your writing? Because on the one hand, I mean, it's just an interesting paradox, because on the one hand, being an outsider like that could easily go hand in hand with, I suppose, developing sharp observational skills and so on. But on the other hand, when you're missing, and I say this, I suppose, as someone who grew up abroad and now works as a journalist in the UK, when you're missing that grounding in sort of popular culture, sometimes it can be difficult to sort of, I suppose, to know what references are going to work. And has that, as a result, kind of fed into what you write about and how you write?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Every writer has to understand that they must write the kind of books that only they can write, and should never try to do anything else. And there's been a couple of times in my life, I think, both as a new writer and, you know, having had two or three books out, when I thought, oh, you know, if only I could write kind of short, elliptical books in very hard, taught contemporary language, dealing with the urgency of you know, late capitalist consumerism and the way people live right now, and you know, all my characters talk as if you've just overheard them in a queue at the supermarket. But I'm never going to do that. You know, there's lots of people who can, and it would be totally fraudulent and totally foolish for me to even begin to try. All I can do is write the world that I see, and I will always see the world as illuminated by the possibility of the supernatural, the possibility of eternity, the presence of a literal and terrifying sin. I will always have a lexis and a diction that comes out of a lifetime reading the King James Bible and reading the poetry of Thomas Hardy when I was a child. And the task for me has been to accept that that's who I am and that's how I write, and work towards the best possible version of that, rather than, you know, wishing that I'd been born into a sort of more ordinary household in London and led a more recognisably contemporary life.
Can you tell me about your path into becoming an author? You have a PhD in creative writing. What was it that made you want to be an author, and how did you go about getting published in the first place?
So the best way I can think of to describe my lifelong desire to write is that most people I know have known that they will be a parent. They haven't chosen to be a parent. They have just assumed from the minute they could conceive of the idea of a future that they would have a child. That's what life looks like. They will have a child. That's going to be their existence. That's what they will be kind of working towards. And if that doesn't happen for some reason, the grief and the sensation of displacement is very, very, very profound. And I have always felt that writing is the equivalent of that for me. There was never a moment when I decided to be a writer. From the minute I even had any idea that there might be something I would do with my life, so we're talking age 3, age 4, I was going to write. I was going to tell stories. I was raised on Bible stories, raised on hearing scripture read aloud. Was constantly telling stories, making them up in my head. I would tell stories to my sister to get her to sleep. And so that was all I was going to do. And the idea that I couldn't do that would have been the equivalent of a woman desperately trying for a child and then not having one. I wouldn't have wanted to be here. That's my whole purpose. That's my whole existence. And consequently, I didn't do any writing at all until my 20s. So I think lots of people will recognise this. You know, if there's something that your entire identity hangs on this thing, then you're afraid to do it, because if you find out you can't, then you've got nothing left. I am from an ordinary background, sort of financially speaking, so I had to earn money. There was, you know, no one was going to pay to put me through university, never mind fund a writing career. So I went and studied English and then immediately became a civil servant. And after about 4 years in the civil service, the fact that I wasn't writing and that instead I'd become this kind of grey-faced, grey-suited office drone in an underground civil service department in London was just breaking my heart. So a friend said to me, enter some competitions and find out if you can write. So I entered the Spectator magazine's travel writing competition and I entered the Vogue Young Journalist of the Year competition. I think I was 25, still had never written any fiction by this stage. And I won the Spectator prize and I was shortlisted for the Vogue prize. And I thought, maybe I can. And then I applied for an MA because I knew I would never write unless someone was telling me to write. So I applied for an MA in creative writing. At this stage, I still had never written any fiction at 25, and gave them my travel essay and an outline of a novel that I wanted to write, and arrived on the MA with that. And it was quite terrifying because everybody in my MA class was published in some way, you know, were on their second or third novel and already had an agent in one case. And there I was, just didn't know what I was doing, hadn't read any books that they'd read, because my whole history of reading was that I was still reading obscure Victorian novels and William Hazlitt essays, and everybody else was on Grace Paley or Cormac McCarthy. I just felt like an outsider again. It was really difficult. And, you know, I did the MA and the PhD, and the whole time I was working full time for the Council of the Inns of Court while I was doing these things. And I was not a particularly admired class member. You know, nobody particularly liked my work. They're very nice about it and they're very helpful, but I was not the one that people thought could go a long way. Even my PhD supervisor wasn't particularly keen. So, you know, I arrived at the age of about 31 with a PhD and a novel, but nobody really liked it. And that, can you imagine? You know, it's pretty depressing if that's the only thing you've ever wanted to do. And then I applied for an agent. So I sent the novel to Hannah Westland at Rogers, Coleridge and White. And you must understand that I had had years and years and years of nobody particularly liking my work. And I had a phone call from her 24 hours later, and I was signed to the agency within about a week. And it was just absolutely extraordinary to have that affirmation after really feeling that I'd failed kind of very badly. So that was my first novel, After Me Comes the Flood, and then nobody wanted to publish it. So I think it was rejected by 14 publishers that I know of over the course of about a year. So I'd arrived in my early 30s and all I had done was write work that nobody wanted. And it was a really hard time, until my agent left the agency and became the publisher at Serpent's Tail and took me for a pint, and no other publisher in the UK wanted me, but my agent was now in a position to publish me, and she said, we will work together. So my debut came out in 2014, and I really had no expectations for it at all. I didn't have any early publicity. I wasn't selected for any lists of people to watch or anything like that, and I was very low. And then I got the most astounding review, I mean just astounding book reviews everywhere in all the newspapers, and suddenly everybody seemed to be reading the book and ordering it in, and it did better than any of us had ever dreamed. So yeah, that's how it began.
And was it the same novel that you'd gone and started the course with? You said you so it had been I mean, years in the making.
Yeah, absolutely.
Years in the making. So how did it feel then when it was published and as you say, received such rave reviews? I mean, was it pure sort of joy and vindication?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, it was absolutely that, because I felt foolish that I had put myself into a situation of penury, actually, where, you know, I had a moderately good brain and I could have stayed in the civil service and, you know, learnt the job, you know, and had a proper job and done better. I could have gone into law or anything. And I'd been hanging on to this idea that I just wanted to write. It was the only thing that I thought I was on the planet for. I just wanted to write. And I'd given up so much for the dream of being able to write. And nobody seemed to want it. And then when finally, at the age of 34, you know, this is a lot. It's a long process. It's a long process. At the age of 34, the book was in the bookshelves and shortlisted for prizes and winning things. And I felt I'm glad I kept the faith, you know. And I talk a lot about what a long struggle it was, because if you were just to look at what happened with the Essex Serpent and you didn't know the years and years and years before that, you might think that I was one, you know, one of those writers who kind of just arrive out of nowhere with everything quite easy for them, which it's not easy for anybody, I have to say. But some of us had a very, very, very long, difficult slog. And there are people who have had longer and more difficult slogs than I have. And I think the more we talk about that, the more encouraging that is for potential writers, because they need to know that you can do this when you have another job that you work at for 12 years and when nobody gives you any money, nobody gives you any sort of encouragement along the way. But if you plug away, it can still happen.
And you mentioned the Essex Serpent there, which became a phenomenon, as well as Melmoth, which, I, by the way, I've always wondered if I'm mispronouncing. So tell me if I am.
Oh, I say Melmoth, but I
yeah, okay,
not
great.
Say Melmoth, so I don't worry about it.
And I mean, I do mispronounce everything. It's not ideal when you have a podcast. But the how do you write? Like, what are you like as a writer? Do you have a routine? Do you have rituals? Do you have to kind of write in specific places? Do you get writer's block? What's your kind of process? And I suppose it's changed somewhat from fitting it in around a full-time job to now writing as a job.
Yeah, it's so I don't have any routines at all. And this is something else that I always think is really important to kind of make clear to people, because you so often hear all this advice about, oh, you must write every day, you must have a set number of words. I mean, you know, if that works for you, that's absolutely fine. But I'm very ramshackle. There will be times when I write 20,000 words in a week, and then I will go 6 months with nothing. And then I will have a week where I do editing, and a month of nothing, and then 6 months of really diligent work. And every book requires a different approach. Every book requires different engagement with the natural world, different engagement with research. So I wrote The Essex Serpent in real time, which means that, you know, the chapter set in October, I wrote in October, and then I wrote across the months and travelled down to Essex to observe the natural world in each month. That wasn't really possible for Melmoth because I was very unwell and I'd had spinal surgery. And anyway, a lot of it was about research into historical periods. So again, that was a completely different approach. I'm working on something now which requires a particular scientific discipline. So I'm pursuing that. So every book is different. I do have little rituals, though. I always have a candle burning, which costs me an absolute fortune at Jo Malone. So, I always write directly into a Word document. I don't write longhand or anything like that. I very rarely keep notes because I'm very disorganised, so I would just lose the notebook. At the moment, I have a plan for my work in progress pinned to the study door behind me, but I haven't referred to it for weeks. So that was a bit of a waste of time. I listen to the same kind of weird ambient music whenever I write, and I have done for about 10 years now. So I get this almost Pavlovian response to the opening chords. I hear it and I think, oh, it must be time to write. I have lots of books on my desk that I just use as little, almost like a sacrament. So I have Virginia Woolf's diaries and the poems of W.S. Graham and Alma Mahler's diaries. And sometimes I'll just dip into them, because when I'm writing a first draft, I don't really like to read novels too much because you can get kind of noise interference.
Yeah.
But poetry and diaries and letters are quite a good way into that. So yeah, I'm afraid I'm a bit ramshackle, really. Just whatever gets it done.
You've spoken before about writing when you were ill and being treated for chronic pain. Can you tell me a bit about that? And obviously, whatever you're comfortable saying, I don't want to pry. But can you tell me about sort of managing that while also writing?
I wish I could, but the truth is that it's all such a blur, like such a drugged out blur, that I actually can remember very little of it. So I've spoken about this before, and I'm happy to talk about it, which is that I was diagnosed in 2015 with an autoimmune disorder called Graves disease, which nowadays is really, generally speaking, not too severe, but it is an incurable, more or less incurable condition, and it weakens your body and it causes bone loss and muscle loss, and combination of things sort of led to me rupturing a disc twice, very, very, very severely. I had about the worst disc injury that you can get. I mean, it was really catastrophic, and surgery was the only answer to just absolutely savage pain and some nerve damage, permanent nerve damage in my leg, which led to a third degree burn that was quite extraordinary. And for various reasons, I couldn't have surgery on the burn because I was having surgery on my back. So I was left with an open wound for 4 months while that healed, while I was healing from surgery. So it wasn't a great time, and it coincided with the great success of the Essex Serpent. And so I was managing to be interviewed. I was interviewed once by the Telegraph while I was lying on the sofa waiting for surgery, and I was on tramadol and diazepam and trying to conduct this interview. And after surgery, I would manage to take enough pain relief to go to an awards ceremony or something, and then I would just come home and not do anything for sort of weeks afterwards. So it was a really strange time. And then somehow during all of that, I wrote a book, and I have these snippets of memory. So I couldn't sit down for a very, very long time, couldn't walk or sit. I was sort of bedbound, and I would put the laptop on the pillow next to my head and try to dictate into the laptop. And that didn't really work, because you then have gobbledygook on your screen and you've got to try and edit it. So I'm sort of, the effect it's had on me is that I'm really impatient with people that don't get on with their books, because they say things like, oh, you know, like I'm really tired after a day at work, and I just roll up my sleeves, or let me tell you about writing a novel under adverse conditions, young lady. So I think it should sort of encourage people to think that however bad things are, if you've got a story that needs telling, then you can tell it.
Do you still have to manage that? Do you still have to sort of... Is it something you have to factor into your writing now?
Almost never. So as my neurosurgeon said with justifiable pride, I had the worst possible disc injury and the best possible outcome from surgery. So I'm now incredibly strong. I walk miles and miles and miles and miles, and I don't have back pain. I will always have Graves' disease, and there's various sort of more or less permanent solutions to the outcome of the Graves' disease, but I'll always have a degree of sort of inflammation and stuff. So, you know, I just have to, if I get overtired, I have to make sure I rest. I can't sit, you know, I can't do an 8-hour writing stint without, factoring in looking after my back. But I would say I'm probably more fit and healthy than the average person, which is just incredible when you think how I was sort of 3 years ago. So I'm unbelievably grateful.
Can we turn back to the book, and can I ask you about some of the kind of really varied array of women that you explore and go into the lives of in the book? I mean, let's start with the person you describe as the grand dam of the only way is Essex.
Yes.
Gemma Collins, who is a literal Essex girl. She is actually an Essex girl. Tell me what you find sort of intriguing and empowering about her.
So you know what's so important, and I've been saying this to people over and over again, and I think they're slightly surprised. I get asked about Tally a lot, and that's one of the reasons I had to put her in the book, because people expect me to say Tally is an absolute disgrace, it's a stain on the name of Essex, these people are dreadful vulgarians, and I don't think that at all. And it is so important to me to try to convey this. You know, what you have in Gemma Collins and in all of them are beautiful, happy, funny young people who are living their lives to the full, who are working and earning money, who understand actually that they're being potentially held up to mockery, but they know that they're doing well out of it and that it's making them well known and beloved. And I think that's just amazing. And I think that for Gemma Collins to be so absolutely what everybody associates with an Essex girl and to inhabit that in a way that, you know, turns her a prophet and sort of makes her more comfortable and more happy is just inspired. So, you know, if somebody says, oh, I don't like The Only Way is Essex, you know, what are you saying? Are you saying you don't like working class people? Are you saying that you think money should be at least three generations back before you should enjoy it? Are you saying that people should speak with received pronunciation to be taken seriously? Do you think people should marry at 20 and, you know, settle down soberly in dark linen clothes? You know, none of us think that. So that's sort of why I wanted to bring her up as being something wonderful and not something to be despised.
Can I ask you about Anne Knight, who is also a literal Essex girl?
Yes, so she is from my hometown, Chelmsford, and I really knew very, very little about her. She was a Quaker, and her name is on the Quaker Meeting House in Chelmsford, which is no longer, sadly, no longer a Quaker Meeting House. And I really didn't think very much of her for years, if at all, until I was researching Essex girls and her photo popped up on Google Images. And it's just the most extraordinary photo from the sort of towards the end of the 19th century of this elderly lady in a huge black dress with sort of buttons down it and a bonnet, a little white lace bonnet. And she's holding up a sign, and the sign is obviously in her handwriting. Well, one assumes it's her handwriting. And I can't remember the exact words, but it ends with "Bid the world be free." And she was an abolitionist. She was born at the end of the 18th century in Chelmsford to a grocer. And what's really important to convey is that she was a Victorian woman as Victorian women actually were, not as we imagine them to be. So, you know, everyone likes to think of Victorian women as kind of fainting onto a couch, having just delivered their 10th baby, and then just going to hem a handkerchief. And they weren't like that. She spoke several languages. She travelled all over Europe. She was an abolitionist. She was deeply involved in politics. And like all good Essex girls, she was really annoying. You know, she believed thoroughly that she was right in what she said, and she would say it at all times. So, for example, she would go to dinner parties with a black silk bag tied around her waist full of abolitionism pamphlets, and she would hand them out during the dinner table and dinner time and sort of force the fellow guests to talk about, you know, where their sugar came from. She thought that nobody should be eating sugar because obviously enslaved people had been responsible for its manufacture. She was absolutely amazing. She was amazing. And she was an Essex girl, absolutely, in the sense that the way she dressed and the way she spoke and the way she behaved was really annoying to the ruling classes. They wanted her to shut up, sit down like a decent, quiet woman and just enjoy her dinner and then go home on time. And she wasn't going to do any of those things.
Just on the, I'm so glad you mentioned the picture of her, because you've actually got the picture in the book. And one of the things that's kind of amazing is in the picture, she's 69 and she's just got the sort of most fearsome kind of dogged look on
her. Yes,
yeah. And the be free, like the sign, I actually can't read the whole sign. It's all in cursive. But what I did notice is be free is in capital letters, right, sort of, yes. Donald Trump tweet style, capital letters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like her version of Twitter. So. But she's just, it just really struck me when I saw that, you know, what are people saying when they try to monitor the way women dress and to change the way women dress? They're saying, you know what, you're inconvenient, you're taking up too much space, you're drawing too much attention to yourself, you should calm down and be quiet. And obviously the way Anne Knight was speaking and dressing is not the same way that Gemma Collins is speaking and dressing, but it's still the same thing. It's women acting out, it's pushing at the boundaries that have been set for them.
And I'm going to ask you about one more, which is Emily Hobhouse, who isn't a literal Essex girl. She's a sort of spiritual Essex girl, but she's from Cornwall. Tell me about her.
Her story I find actually quite heartbreaking because of the way it ended. And I think me telling her story is a way to kind of counter that. So she was a middle class Cornish girl. And she looked after her very elderly, ailing vicar father for years and years. And then the minute he died, she just ricocheted off all over the world having fun. So she went to America, lost a fortune in bad investments. And she bought a ranch that didn't do very well. She got engaged. She broke off the engagement. And she was very vital in her belief that she had sort of social obligations and political obligations. So at the time, there were lots of Cornish miners working over in America, and she built them a library, and she made sure that they had access to education, and she helped at the local hospital, and she did Bible studies, actually. And all the men out there in America were horrified. You know, what's this woman doing a Bible study? What's this woman doing setting up libraries? This is not appropriate. And then the Boer War broke out, sort of the end of the 19th, early 20th century. And she began to worry about the plight of the South African women. And that's really typical of Emily Hobhouse, that she was worried about, in inverted commas, the enemy. And she investigated and she discovered, to her absolute horror, that the British were running concentration camps and that white South Africans and black South Africans were imprisoned in these concentration camps. They had initially been set up as a kind of internment for a certain type of South African that wasn't getting involved in the war, but they burgeoned into your actual genuine concentration camps. And all British school children should know that the British invented the concentration camp. It's high time that we did away with the British exceptionalist view of history. You know, we invented concentration camps. And they salted the earth of the South African farms, and they imprisoned the wives and the children of the men that were fighting. And if the men didn't lay down their arms, the children would be punished by having restricted rations. And there was typhoid, you know, all of the illnesses that we associate with concentration camps. And she made her reports, and she, Millicent Fawcett went out and they presented some reports to Parliament. And the result of this was twofold. Firstly, that something was done about the state of the concentration camps, but secondly, that Emily Hobhouse was despised and she was called a traitor. She was never remembered when she died, having been responsible for, you know, really, really important benevolent foreign policy. Nobody went to her funeral. She was cremated and there was nobody at her funeral, and a stranger signed for her ashes. But her ashes were sent over to South Africa, to Bloemfontein, and her ashes are buried at the foot of the war memorial. And she sketched a mother and her dying child in a concentration camp, and the sculptor sculpted this incredible war memorial from that. So, you know, she is an extraordinary person, but she died alone and forgotten because she spoke out of turn, because she spoke against the establishment, and, you know, It's really sad, and that's what happens if women don't do as they're told.
She said something rather wonderful, which you quote in the book, which is, "Pens won't adequately tell all I have seen and done," which I think is a rather fantastic thing for someone to say of their life. Can I ask, before I let you go, what is next for you? You're obviously busy talking about Essex Girls at the moment, but what do you have sort of further down the pipeline?
Well, I'm working on my next novel and having a really wonderful time, and I've had this tendency to kind of set myself actually fairly arbitrary deadlines and to not kind of relish what I'm doing. So I'm trying to take all the time that I need for this, because there's no great rush, really. I'm not in contract or anything, and it's contemporary, set in Essex, but it's my Essex. I'm sort of starting to conceive of a way of building my version of Essex and of continuing to kind of write there. And I'm really enjoying it. And my main character is an amateur astronomer, and I'm into astronomy. I have a very good telescope. So I've been spending a lot of time looking at the stars and looking at the planets and the moon and having a really wonderful time. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying myself.
And one final thing before I completely let you go, which is a question I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, which is, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would just say, just carry on doing what you're doing. I don't think I would change anything. I think that all she needed to know was to believe that one day it would happen. And, at 16, I would have been absolutely appalled if you had told me that my debut would be published when I was 34. You know, I would have thought I was already an old lady by then, and I would have been, you know, really upset. But I would have asked her to just carry on believing and to carry on sort of having this sensation that there's only one thing worth doing, and that one day I would end up doing it. And I had such a strong sense that I was going to write that it's almost as if I did feel that, you know, it's almost as if when I was 15, I did go back and have a word with myself and say it's going to be okay.
Well, that is fantastic advice and a great note to end on. Sarah, thank you so much. That was really riveting. That was so interesting. And to everyone listening, Essex Girls is out now. So that's it from us. Thank you very much for listening to the Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode with me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alice Cezania. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about leaving a rating or review. It really helps other people find it and boosts its success in the charts. So until next week, thank you very much and goodbye.